This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. Okay, our second lecture in the series, An Islam Primer. Tonight we're going to look at the Quran, Islam's holy book. Surah 22:54 opens this way: "And that those on whom knowledge has been bestowed may learn that the Quran is the truth from your Lord, and that they may believe therein, and their hearts may be made humbly open to it. For verily, Allah is the guide of those who believe to the straight way." In reviewing even just a portion of the literature treating Islam, it becomes immediately obvious that the Quran is foundational to Islam. Indeed, no adequate knowledge of Islam can be gained without a basic understanding of the Quran. For Muslims, acceptance of the Quran as divine revelation is not merely an intellectual dogma, but a daily and lifelong reality. Employed in public and private devotions, recited at festivals and family occasions, understood as the basis of religious belief, of ritual, and of law, the Quran both regulates Muslim conduct and molds Muslim thought. As one Muslim has stated the matter, essentially, Islam is the Quran. Although it is true that a major tenet of Islamic doctrine is belief in all divine scriptures, yet for Muslims, the Quran holds such an incomparable place amongst the other revealed scriptures that it simply demands a separate treatment. And so it's tonight that we continue our lecture series by giving attention to Islam's holy book, Al-Quran. Now, before moving on into the substance of tonight's lecture, there are a couple of things that I think will serve us well before we get into it. I want to briefly do two things. I'd like to review the nature of this series so that we all know what to expect, and then I want to outline tonight's lecture so that we know where we're going. Regarding the nature of this series, three things ought to be kept in mind. One, as an Islam primer, this lecture series is basic. It is fundamental. It is simply an introduction to the most central and basic aspects of a Muslim's faith. We're not trying to cover the whole ground. We're not trying to be comprehensive or exhaustive. My aim in this series is to simply set forth the basic content of the Islamic world and life view. Second, the chief goals of this lecture series are to impart a basic understanding of Islam, to assist in promoting an informed response and a meaningful response to Muslim claims, and to encourage and equip Christians in particular to get to know, befriend, and talk with Muslims. Third, though brief and rather popularist in style, yet this lecture series strives to be fair in presenting the Islamic position. To this end, I have consulted and will frequently draw upon Muslim sources, the Quran itself, the prophetic traditions, and the work of acknowledged scholars of Islam. Now, this brings us to tonight's lecture. Whereas last time we focused on Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam, tonight we turn our attention to the holy book of Islam, to which the prophet himself is inextricably linked. Now, my great dilemma tonight is that there is so much material and so many directions that I could move in that I simply spent most of the week overwhelmed. However, in keeping with the aim of the series and in light of the feedback of some of the students here this week, particularly my yesterday morning's breakfast group, what I've decided to do this evening is to simply focus on three areas that I think will be especially relevant to helping us understand the Quran. Like last time, the general movement of tonight's lecture will be from the historical, into the more directly theological. But tonight I want our thoughts to centre around three main questions. First, in focusing on the material formation of the Quran, I want to ask and answer the question, how did we get the Quran? Second, in focusing on the Quran's external form, that is, on the Quran as we have it and can read it today, I want to answer the question, what do we here tonight need to know in order to read the Quran and begin to appreciate how it functions within Islam? Third, in focusing on the Quran as holy scripture, I want to ask and answer the question, how do Muslims regard the Quran? That is, what do they claim for this holy book? So the Quran's material formation. In taking up the topic of the Quran's material formation, we are really concerning ourselves with the history of the text, and in particular, with the collection of the Quran. To put it simply, we are now asking, how did we get from Muhammad's experience and proclamation of divine revelation to a holy book? Or to state the question still more pointedly, by what process and by whose hands and authority were the verbal revelations directly dictated to Muhammad, recorded, collected, and arranged into what we now know as the Quran? Now, in keeping with the nature of this series, my desire tonight is to basically ignore recent critical investigations of the text, and this in favour of presenting the traditional Islamic account of the Quran's collection, an account that has been more or less adopted by most Western scholars. Historically, the traditional or orthodox account can be said to proceed among these three lines. First, the revelation of the Quran during the life of the Prophet Muhammad. According to all traditional accounts, and as we discussed in our previous lecture, the Quran was revealed to Muhammad directly, in words, in the Arabic language by an angel, Gabriel. Muhammad commenced receiving Quranic revelation during the month of Ramadan in about 610 AD, and he continued receiving such revelation up until the time of his death in 632. Thus, the Quran was revealed gradually and in portions over a period of 23 years. During the Prophet's own lifetime, not only he, but also a number of his companions committed the Quranic revelation to memory. As time went on, it seems that many numbers of other people also did this and began to recite the Quran in their prayers. Islamic tradition suggests that each verse was memorized and recited with its location relative to other verses and surahs being identified by the Prophet himself. We are told that some of the Prophet's companions not only memorized the Quran, but also wrote down various passages for their own use. Later, there is a tradition of Muhammad employing scribes and secretaries while at Medina, and to these people he would dictate passages and tell them where to place the newly revealed passages in relation to the previously revealed ones. Among those employed in the writing down of the Quranic revelations were Uthman and Zayd ibn Thabit, both of whom would eventually play a significant role in the formation of the Quran. Still, and for all this, Islamic tradition itself states that there was no complete edition of the Quran in existence at the time of the Prophet's death. No written manuscript was collected while Muhammad was still alive. Now, this may seem surprising to us, but as 7th century Arabian culture was marked by a strong oral tradition, and the Arabic script in use at the time served mainly as an aid to memorization, it is not at all surprising that the Quran existed primarily in people's memories. Furthermore, so long as Muhammad was living, the whole could not be written down, lest a further verse or surah be revealed to him while alive. So up to the time of the Prophet's death, the Quran was known, memorized, recited, passages began to be written down, but there was no complete compilation or copy. This brings us to the second phase, the collection of the Quran during the caliphate of Abu Bakr. We're dealing here with the year 632 to 634. According to Islamic tradition, the next phase in the formation of the Quran revolves around Umar ibn al-Khattab, who urged Abu Bakr, Muhammad's successor and the first caliph, to preserve and compile the Quran. Arising out of the Battle of Umama and the resultant loss of many Muslims who had memorized the Quran, Umar feared that if more of these men who knew the Quran were lost in battle, then the Quran itself might be irretrievably lost. This led Umar to urge Abu Bakr to make a collection of all of the Quran's parts. It seems that at first Abu Bakr was reluctant to start on such a project, having himself not received that kind of instruction from the Prophet. Nonetheless, he acquiesced and commissioned Zayd ibn Thabit, who had been one of Muhammad's secretaries, to undertake this work. The traditional account of this collection, which appears to go back to Zayd himself, says that he collected the Quran primarily from the hearts of men, that is, from memory. And yet, we are also told that he collected the Quran from the chance surfaces that it had been written on, pieces of papyrus, flat stones, the ribs of palm leaves, shoulder blades and the ribs of animals, pieces of leather and wooden boards, etc. Zayd wrote what he collected on sheets of equal size, and having accomplished his task, handed over to the Caliph Abu Bakr the first complete and authenticated copy of the Quran in written form. When Abu Bakr died in 634, this was passed on to Umar ibn al-Khattab, his successor and the second caliph. And on Umar's death in 644, it was passed on to his daughter Hafsa, who is one of the widows of the Prophet. The collection of the Quran during the Caliphate of Uthman, 644 through to 656 are the years that we're now looking at. The traditional account of what led to this third phase would seem to suggest that the collection made under Abu Bakr's oversight and entrusted to Hafsa did not function with any canonical authority. It also suggests that serious differences of reading existed in the copies of the Quran current in various districts. According to Islamic tradition, rapid Muslim expansion brought to light a dispute concerning the reading of the Quran. At the edges of the empire, Muslims were arguing over what was Quranic and what was not. And during expeditions against Armenia and Azerbaijan, disputes concerning the reading of the Quran arose even amongst Muslim troops themselves. Deeming this sectarian controversy to be a matter serious enough to lay before the caliph, General Khalifa petitioned Uthman to take steps to settle such differences. Uthman then took counsel with senior companions of the Prophet and finally commissioned Zayd ibn Thabit, who had made the former collection, and a council of others to make perfect copies of the authenticated copy kept with Hafsa. This committee brought together as many copies as they could obtain and prepared an edition that was to become canonical for all Muslims. And in the case of difficulty as to the reading, the dialect of the Quraysh tribe, to which the Prophet Muhammad himself had belonged, was to be given preference. A number of copies of this prepared text were distributed to the main centres of the Islamic world, while the original authenticated copy was returned to Hafsa and a second copy was kept in Medina. To prevent further disputes, it is said that the committee burned all the other copies and that Uthman ordered all incomplete and imperfect collections of the Quran to be destroyed. The result was a standardized written version of the Quran that functioned authoritatively and which remains with us to this day. Established between 650 and 656, it is this collection that is the cardinal point in what I've spoken of as the material formation of the Quran. All this is to say that it is essentially Uthman's Quran that we hold and read in our hands today. Now, why is this so important? Well, it is important to have a knowledge of the Quran's collection and formation, because if you're a Muslim, it is this that grounds the claim to the purity of the Quranic text. Tracing the lineage of the text back through the various caliphs to Muhammad and to the Prophet's own recitation and arrangement of the Quran anchors the Muslim's claim that what he holds in his hand now is exactly what Allah revealed to his messenger. Listen to one Muslim scholar make this very point. Amongst all the religious books of the world, the Holy Quran is the only book which enjoys the distinction of having a pure text. Every word and letter of the Holy Book as we have it today is as it left the lips of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, to whom the book was revealed. And it is for this reason that through all the centuries since it was revealed, and amongst all the Muslims from east to west, amongst the numerous contending sects, there is only one Quran. It is the only revealed book in which one can have access with the fullest certainty to that divine light which was revealed to the heart of a prophet of God. The factors which contributed to this safe preservation of the text are the very things that we just recounted. The scholar grounds the purity of the Quranic text in this careful collection of the Quran. This brings us then to the Quran's external form. Leaving the matter of the Quran's formation behind, we turn now to focus on understanding the Quran. As we approach Islam's primary document, I want to ask and answer the question, what do we here tonight need to know in order to read the Quran and begin to appreciate how it functions within Islam? Firstly, the Quran is not the Bible. Given our current setting, I think the first thing that I need to say is that the Quran is not the Bible. What I mean by this is that if we wish to read and understand the Quran, then we must disabuse ourselves of certain expectations. Expectations such as authorial and cultural diversity. For whereas the Bible was written by numerous authors over many millennia in many locations, the Quran was not. It was written by a single prophet in a single territory within the space of a single quarter century. And this affects the way that it reads. We must also rid from our minds any expectation of chronology. Whereas biblical books and stories generally follow a chronological order or a sequence in which they can easily be placed, this is simply not true of the Quran. In addition, we must also dissuade ourselves from expecting an essentially familiar redemptive history. Even though familiar biblical figures and events are referenced in the Quran, yet they are rehearsed in divergent forms and Arabicized in order to confirm Muhammad's prophethood, to corroborate Quranic authority, and to depict for Muslims the meaning and destiny of the Islamic cause. All this is to say that we cannot approach the Quran simply as we would the Bible. The Quran is different in all these ways and many more besides, and we must be prepared for this. Which now brings us to the Quran itself. I might get Doug to put that first overhead up. So the next section here is a little bit shotgun. I want to look at the main issues that I think will be helpful for us as non-Muslims to understand the Quran. And so I've picked and chose from various areas that we could go in. And I want to begin with looking at the arrangement and the structure of the Quran. In order to read the Quran and appreciate the way in which it functions, we need to begin by examining the way in which Islam's holy book is arranged. Now, although Muslims divide the Quran in various ways to facilitate memorization and reciting, yet the real divisions within the body of the Quran are surahs. Surahs. Although it is not an exact equivalent, it is helpful to think of surahs as chapters. Thus we can speak of the Quran as having 114 chapters, or 114 surahs. The first surah, up here on the overhead, is known as the Fatiha, or the opening, and it is said to contain the whole of the Quran in a nutshell. As a short prayer, this surah is frequently used in Islam, with strict Muslims repeating it 17 times or more per day. its seven verses are translated into English as follows. In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, praise be to Allah, the cherisher and sustainer of worlds, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. You do we worship and your aid do we seek. Show us the straight way, the way of those on whom you have bestowed your grace, those whose portion is not wrath and who do not go astray. This is the opening surah of the Quran. Now, generally, the surahs are arranged in order of length, although both the first surah, this one, and the final two surahs demonstrate that this is not always the case. Some surahs are quite long. The second surah, for example, is the largest and is comprised of 286 verses, or 1/12 the entire Quran. Other surahs are quite short. The smallest surah, the 103rd surah, consists of only 3 verses. Now, when it comes to the longer surahs, they divide it up into rukus, or sections, with each section generally dealing with one subject. Swap overheads for me, Doug. When reading the Quran, you soon notice that each surah has a name or a title, and it is this name, not the number, that is normally used by Muslim scholars for referring to the surah. As a general rule, the name is no real reference to the subject matter of the surah, but is taken from some prominent or unusual word in it, a word sufficiently striking so as to identify the one surah from others. Sometimes a surah has 2 such titles, with both still in use today. This is true, for example, of Surah 9 and Surahs 40 and 41. The suggestion is that these names do not belong to the Quran itself, but were introduced by later scholars for convenience of reference. In copies of the Quran, both written and printed, the commencement of each surah is marked by a heading that contains the following information. The name or title of the surah. So here we have it up here. Khatmim. We also have, after the name or title, a statement about its date, revealed at Mecca. Typically, this does not go beyond the bare description of whether a surah fits into the Prophet's Medinan stage or his earlier Meccan stage. It also does not necessarily apply to the surah as a whole, because some surahs are composite. So what I'm saying is we have this basic time frame designated here, and yet some surahs are composite, so this time frame does not apply all the way through. Thirdly, there is then a note about the number of verses and the sections if it's long enough. So we've got 6 sections, or rukus, and there are 54 verses in this 41st surah. After this heading comes the Bismillah. Down here. The Bismillah is placed at the beginning of every surah except the 9th surah, and the phrase Bismillahi Rahmani Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. The Bismillah functions as an invocation or a petition in which the Muslim believer seeks or expresses Allah's assistance. So here's the basic structure. When you go to the Quran, these are the things that you will see are printed there. And these are the things that help you to understand where this surah is located or placed. After surahs, we need to look at verses. Surahs are not only divided into rukus, or sections, but also into verses that are termed ayat, plural, or ayah, singular. Strictly speaking, the idea is not that of verses that we're familiar with, but rather that of sign or wonder. Unlike our Bibles, whose division into verses was quite artificially imposed, it is held that the verse divisions of the Quran belong to the original form, and they mark the distinct occurrence of rhyme or assonance within the text. The length of verses, like the length of surahs, varies a good deal. Generally, in longer surahs, the verses tend to be longer and trailing, while in shorter surahs, the verses tend to be shorter and crisper. In total, there are 6,247 verses in the Holy Quran, or 6,360 if we include the Bismillah. This brings us next to what I refer to as the mystery letters. At the beginning, if we put the other overhead on, Doug, thanks. At the beginning of 29 surahs and following the Bismillah stands a letter or group of letters which are simply read as separate letters. Here's an example here. Although a number of proposals as to the presence or purpose of these letters exist, yet these letters really are a mystery. No satisfactory explanation of their meaning seems to exist, and no convincing reason for their placement has been given. The most common explanation is that the letters are shorthand forms of divine names. However, the only thing really agreed upon by Muslim scholars is that these letters belong to the original text and were not external marks added later. Here again is the basic structure. When you approach the Quran, these are the things that you need to look for. Surahs, rukus, ayats or verses, the presence of the Bismillah, the little notation that tells you if it comes from Medina or Mecca. These will help you to understand the Quran. Thanks, Doug, we can flip that off. Another key division in the Quran, and one hinted at in the headings of the surahs that we've just seen, is that of Meccan and Medinan revelations. During the 13 years that Muhammad resided in Mecca, 93 surahs were revealed to him. While he was in Medina for 10 years, a further 21 surahs were revealed. Although there are less Medinan surahs, yet these tend to be longer and contain about one-third of the entire Quran. Now, lest one thinks that this twofold schema provides a chronological key, it ought to be pointed out that the arrangement of the Quran intermixes the Meccan and Medinan revelations. So, for example, the Quran opens with a Meccan surah, which is followed by four Medinan surahs, which are then followed by Meccan and Medinan revelations in various alternating orders. This intermixing, along with the fact that it is difficult to date particular surahs even within the Prophet's Meccan and Medinan periods, has led even the best Muslim scholars to conclude that the attempt to give a chronological order is an undoubted failure. This brings us to the language and literary style of the Quran. Although those of us who do not speak Arabic cannot adequately comprehend this, yet it is essential to realize that the Quran was revealed in and is written in Arabic. As any Muslim will tell you, Arabic is not incidental, but essential to the nature of the Quran. For Arabic is sacred in the sense that it is an integral part of the Quranic revelation, whose very sounds and utterances play a role in the ritual acts of Islam. Stated succinctly, the text of the Quran is held to be written in perfect Arabic because Allah wrote it and revealed it in this way. As our one younger Muslim friend of mine tends to state it, if it isn't in Arabic, buddy, it isn't the Quran. Stylistically, the Quran is written in the form of Arabic poetry and prose. Although it bears the stamp of a single author throughout, yet most scholars recognize that there is a shift between earlier and later surahs. In the earlier surahs, the language is often exalted, rhapsodic, and quite fanciful, coming very close to rhymed prose. In the later surahs, one notices a shift to a more detailed and complex outlook and use of language. The vivid expressions and poetical force of earlier surahs are by no means completely abandoned, but circumstance and intent meant that there is an increase in longer stories and sometimes mundane legislation. Another point to note regarding the style of the Quran is the way in which the Quran is cast mainly in the form of Allah addressing Muhammad, and not one of Muhammad addressing other men. Typically, Allah speaks in the first person plural, we. And when Muhammad does speak, his words are often introduced, say, alerting us to the fact that he is speaking divine words at divine behest. Sadly, and though in all honesty, it must be said that the Quran is a difficult book to read in translation. There are frequent and dramatic shifts in style, voice and subject matter. It assumes a familiarity with words, events and stories that were lost to even the earliest readers. At times, Allah is referred to in the first and third person in the same sentence. Divergent accounts of the same story appear in differing places, and some portions abrogate other portions of the text and defend the right to do so. Fortunately, however, when a good reader in a mosque or on the radio reads the Quran aloud in Arabic, it does make a tremendous impression on the listener. In our English translations, there is something to the Quran not being able to be translated. It's very wooden, and it uses forms that are very hard for us to identify with. But even as a non-Arabic speaker, when you hear the Quran spoken by somebody who knows how to speak Arabic, it is melodic, almost hypnotic, and quite beautiful. This brings us, fifthly, to the relation of the Quran to the Sunnah. While the Holy Quran is the fountainhead from which all the teachings of Islam are drawn, and while the Quran is the final authority relating to the religion of Islam, yet it is not the sole authority. A second authoritative source of law exists. It's called the Sunnah. Sunnah, meaning mode of life, especially the course of the Holy Prophet's life, is used in the religious terminology of Islam to indicate the practices and sayings of Muhammad. Technically, the life of Muhammad is known as Sirah, while the daily utterances and discourses of Muhammad, from the day he first received Quranic revelation until the day of his death, are known as Hadith. Together, the Sirah and the Hadith constitute the Sunnah, and as a record of the deeds and sayings of Muhammad, which were acted or spoken under the influence of the Holy Spirit or the Divine Spirit, Muslims were quick to view the Sunnah as a second authoritative source. Therefore, to have a good understanding of the Quran and of Muslim thinking in general, one really must have some acquaintance with this additional material. This is by no means an easy task, given that there are 7,413 hadith sayings attributed to the Prophet and considered to be authentic. There are collections of these sayings that run into many, many volumes. One of the most common collections is by Bukhari, a 6-volume collection of the sayings that were recorded by Muhammad. And in order to really understand the Quran and to know how the Quran functions, one must have a working knowledge of the Hadith or the Sunnah as well. We're working with two forms of textual authority, which is very different from what many of us as Christians may be used to. This then brings us to the question of interpretation. In light of Surah 3:7, which talks about two kinds of verses, those that are decisive or clear, and which form the basis of Quranic teaching and the fundamental principles of religion, and those that are allegorical, and therefore susceptible to various interpretations, Muslims encourage the Quran to be read as a whole, and to seek the explanation of one passage by referring to other relevant passages. Now, to help you in your perusal or study of the Quran, the following rules or principles of interpretation may be laid down. As the basic principles of Islam are stated in decisive words in the Quran, no attempt should be made to establish a principle on the strength of an allegorical passage or on words susceptible to different meanings. The explanation of the Quran should, in the first place, be sought in the Quran itself. What is stated or merely hinted at in one place will, generally, be found to be expounded on elsewhere in the Holy Book. Also, we must bear in mind that the Quran contains allegory and metaphor along with plain speech, and that the only safeguard against being misled by passages employing figurative speech is to interpret such passages against or in light of what is taught in clear and decisive words. After the Quran itself, interpretation has to be sought within the framework of the life, sayings and actions, the Sunnah, of the Prophet, which functions and provides a commentary on the Quran. Also, the rules and nature of the Arabic language is also to be used as a source of Quranic interpretation. I take the time to lay out these principles, hoping that any of you who are interested in trying to read the Quran or understand the Quran, or any who does have friendships with Muslims, may know how to go about handling the Quran in the middle of discourse and dialogue. It's frequently been embarrassing when talking with Muslim friends to have the Quran in a way that is totally unfamiliar to a Muslim, that carries no weight and no meaning to them. And it also means that we are very quick to attribute false meanings of certain Quranic passages, not knowing how to go about comparing one Quranic passage to another. So there is some value in knowing even these basic principles of interpretation. Having looked now at how the Quran was collected, having considered several areas that ought to help us approach the Quran, we turn now to focus on the Quran as holy scripture. And here I want to ask and answer the question, how do Muslims regard the Quran? What do they claim for it? Let me make several related points here. The Quran is wholly divine. Throughout the Quran itself, we are constantly reminded that the Quran is not a human product, but it comes wholly from Allah himself. Allah revealed the Quran. Allah taught the Quran. And no one save Allah could ever produce the Quran. The Islamic doctrine of revelation points out that the form and the content, as well as the message and the actual words of revelation, are all attributed to an external source, to Allah. For Muslims, Muhammad is merely an instrument or a conduit. He is neither author nor editor, but God's intermediary who received the Quran by dictation. To summarize, for the pious Muslim, the Quran is not the word of a prophet, but the unadulterated word of Allah, which has now become audible through Muhammad. Second, the Quran is errorless, eternal, and uncreated. As a literal word of God sent down from heaven, the Quran is held to be errorless, eternal, and uncreated. It is said to be without error, since Allah can, of course, not utter error. It is said to be eternal, as Muslims also believe that the Quran is a copy of the original glorious Quran that resides in heaven on a preserved tablet. That the Quran we read and recite from has an eternal, original template in heaven has given rise to the view that the Quran was not created, but is actually the uncreated speech of God that has existed in the mind of God from all eternity. Third, the Quran is the divine guide for all humanity. On numerous occasions, the Quran refers to itself as a clear argument, or as a light, or as the explanation. What these designates suggest is that the Quran offers sure guidance. And all over the world, Muslims look to the Quran as revealing the will and the commands of Allah. Even though the Quran does not center on revealing Allah himself, yet the Quran is extolled as the most suitable divine guidance for man. And so the following quotation is typical of many. The Quran is a comprehensive code of life, covering every aspect and phase of human life. This book of God lays down the best rules relating to social life, commerce, economics, marriage and inheritance, penal laws, and international conduct. It is the best guide, a sure guide, for all mankind. 4. The Quran is the final and ultimate revelation of Allah. Muslims believe that in the providence of Allah, there has been a long succession of prophets who were sent to all ages and all nations with essentially the same message. This line of prophets stretches from Adam all the way down to Muhammad, who comes not with a new message, but with a definitive restatement of the truth claimed by all the previous prophets. Whereas each revelation given beforehand was expanded, or modified, or abrogated by later revelation, Muhammad comes as the seal of the prophets, and the Quran comes as the final revelation containing the most perfect answers to all questions regarding belief and conduct. Connecting this point with the previous one, it is accurate to say that for the Muslim, The Quran is the final revelation, is the perfection and culmination of all the truth contained in the earlier scriptures. Though sent in Arabic, it is the book for all times and for all mankind. The purpose of the Quran is to guard the previous revelations by restoring the eternal truth of Allah. The Quran is the torchlight by which humanity can be rightly guided onto the straight path. The Quran is the ultimate divine miracle. Not only is the Quran the ultimate divine revelation, but for Muslims, the Quran is also the ultimate miracle. Indeed, the miracle of the Quran is perhaps the most popular and fundamental doctrine about the Quran. The miracle of the Quran centres around the fact that an illiterate prophet, Muhammad, spoke such perfect words. Confidence in the miraculousness of the Quran continues unshaken to this day, and it functions as an essential evidence for the prophethood of Muhammad. As Muhammad did not claim any miracles for himself, save for the sublime beauty and greatness of the revelation he received and proclaimed, this particular tenet is really quite foundational. As a consequence, Muslim apologists have worked very hard at offering many evidences for the divine origin and miraculous nature of their holy book. Some of the arguments set forth with the most confidence include the argument from unique literary style. According to this argument, the Quran is so wonderfully arranged, so marvellously composed, and so exalted in its literary elegance that it is just impossible that any creature could have produced it. Hence, the Quran challenges people to produce even one surah like it. There is also the argument for Muhammad's illiteracy. If it is a marvel in itself that a literary masterpiece like the Quran was produced at all, then it is even more amazing that it was written by someone who was illiterate. The argument from perfect preservation, that the Holy Quran is the only divinely revealed scripture in the history of mankind which has been preserved to the present time in its exact original form, also argues for its miraculous nature. The argument from the unity of the Quran. Sometimes Islamic scholars appeal to the fact that the Quran has no contradictions as evidence of its divine origin. In the words of Surah 4, the Quran, "Do they not consider the Quran with care? Had it been from other than Allah, they would surely have found therein much discrepancy." The argument from transforming power. Sometimes Muslims point to the way that lives and cultures are affected by the Quran. In the words of one Muslim author, the Quran's purifying power was so great that those who accepted the message had their lives entirely transformed. In fact, the transformation wrought by the Holy Quran is unparalleled in the history of the world, and thus its claim to being unique stands as unchallenged today as it did 13 centuries ago. So here are some of the arguments that Muslim apologists offer for the miraculous and divine nature of the Quran. We also need to note that the Quran is inimitable and untranslatable. Derived from the fact that the Quran is a divine word par excellence, and its being written in Arabic is an essential feature of the Quran, Muslims have considered it inconceivable to translate their holy book into any other language. As the literal word of God, the Quran is the Quran only in the original text. A translation can never really be the Quran. A translation can only be an attempt to give a suggestion of the meaning of the words contained in the Quran. According to Islamic doctrine, the style of the Quran is inimitable. Its superhuman beauty and power cannot be translated into any Western language. The interlocking character of each word and verse, the eloquence and beauty of its language, and the precision, economy, and subtlety of its style all make it impossible to alter or reproduce the Quran. The inimitability of the Quran, together with its perfection, means that no mortal can translate the Quran into any other language. There it is, with both the historical and the cultural religious discussion now over, I begin to hear the unmentioned question. Well, you obviously spent far too much time reading far too many books. What do you think? What do you make of such claims? What is your personal opinion, reflection, thought? Bearing in mind that I will have much more to say about this in later lectures, I want to conclude tonight by personally stating, and this with real respect, that I just do not believe the Muslim claims at face value. I do not believe that Muslim claims fit the facts. Whether we are talking about the collection of the Quran, the state of the text, or the miraculous nature and divine origin of the holy book, I fail to see how Muslim claims correspond with true history. For example, with regard to the traditional Muslim account of the collection of the Quran, I have to say that the traditional accounts of the Quran's collection are open to real criticism. Not only do these accounts not come down to us through history, they come to us through oral hadith. They also come down in different versions. A number of various versions of these accounts exist. And even when we take the traditions at face value and harmonize them as I have done tonight, significant questions still arise. Why didn't Abu Bakr's collection function authoritatively? In the disputes that arose in the Muslim Empire, why was no reference made to the official codex already said to be in the caliph's possession? Why did Uthman have to standardize a common text if a standard text already existed? Why did he deem it necessary to destroy all the other manuscripts if there were no other conflicting manuscripts? Regarding the text of the Quran and Muslim claims for its divine origin, I ask myself, what then do I do with recent textual finds that clearly point to an evolving text rather than to one that has remained unchanged since the time of Muhammad? How am I to regard the early Muslim scholars who reference pre-Uthmanic or non-canonical readings, readings that exhibit variations in the number of surahs, in the length of particular surahs, and which express different wordings? Since Muslims claim that the Quran was handed down from heaven and that Muhammad cannot be its human author, how do we account for the Arabic of the Quran being in the dialect and vocabulary of someone who was a member of the Quraishi tribe living in the city of Mecca in the middle of the 7th century? And if Allah alone is the source of the Quran, what do I do with all those terms, ideas, and doctrines that are clearly traceable to human origin and to other faiths and other philosophies prior to the Prophet's own age? As much as I've read, as much as I've studied, I honestly have not found Muslim claims compelling or to fit the facts. But more of this in later lectures. Are there any questions? The question is regarding the surahs and their relationship to each other. Are they not chronological in some way? Revelation came to Muhammad chronologically. He received various aspects of Quranic revelation while situated in Mecca. And then after the Hijrah, as he moved to Medina, he continued to receive revelation. So there was a chronology to the way that the Prophet received revelation. But the text does not preserve the order. Surahs are not put together chronologically, but simply in terms of size or length. Oh, okay. And not only that, various surahs have been put together in a way that portions of one surah come from Mecca and portions from the same surah come from Medina. And on top of that, it's also very hard to date with any specificity which revelation fits into which period. So there really is no functional chronology that we can use to date or to place particular verses. Some are more obvious than others. For example, Surah 96, the first five verses, are uniformly taken as the first piece of revelation to come to Muhammad. So we know it's Meccan. Yet beyond that, after verse 5, verses 6 and following come from a later period. And there is a disagreement about as to which time and place. So that's what I mean in terms of chronology. Revelation has a chronology to Muhammad, but the Quran is not laid out chronologically, and it's very difficult to date and place particular texts.
Did he write down the revelation as it came to him, but then pass it on orally?
Did Muhammad write it down as it came to him, or did he pass it on orally? Various traditions relate different things. The best traditions and the way the Quran presents itself was that that revelation came to Muhammad directly, immediately, in a very overpowering way. It talks about him having sweats and shivers, being wrapped up in a blanket. So it was very experiential, and at the time he was told to recite, not to write down. And at one point it seems, if my memory serves me correctly, and my memory's not good to rely upon, that Muhammad wanted to write things down as it came to him, but he was told by the angel not to, but simply to hear and to recite. Later on, at what point, we don't know, later on Muhammad himself did begin to record various portions of the Quran. And then much later on in Medina, he obviously began to collect reliable people as scribes and to dictate to them what he had received. But there's a time gap. Yes, sir, in the back. Well, and the question, if you didn't hear it, was I've been referencing Muhammad, and the question is, but we thought Muhammad was illiterate. That's a very insightful comment, and that's one of the Achilles heels of the traditional accounts. It says Muhammad is claimed to be illiterate, and yet he was known to be able to write things down. Some say, but he wrote for other people. But we also, there are other accounts of him as a successful tradesman signing receipts and writing things down. Various conservative Muslim scholars exalt or lift up the idea of Muhammad's illiteracy as a dogma. That is, it has a theological weight to it. Historically, we don't know if he was illiterate. In fact, all the evidence points against it. Not only that, early Muslims themselves have spoken and denied that he was illiterate. They've said that he was unfamiliar with other religious options, but that he was not illiterate in the strict sense of the word. So there's that aspect of Muhammad's life is questioned. Tom? Two questions there. I'll take them separately. The question of what manuscripts do we have extant today, and the question of translation. Dealing with the question of manuscripts, we really have very little. In the 1970s, in Yemen, they've uncovered a codices, a collection of the Quran that is their oldest extant Quran, but it goes back to about 750, so it's still 100 or more years after Muhammad. Interestingly, that codex exhibits script alterations and textual variants and differences. Beyond that, we do not have any original manuscripts. They were burned or destroyed by Uthman, the caliph. Uthman's standard codex, no one has ever seen it. It has never been produced. All the Muslim scholars, when I say all, Western scholars of Islam and more Western-influenced Muslim scholars have acknowledged that it's very doubtful that there was such a text. It seems to be one part of religious dogma. So we don't have very many texts at all. However, there are early Western scholars have looked at the Qurans we do have and have noticed and have seen with the variations that there were certain codices before Uthman, and indeed some of the early Muslim commentators refer to quite openly various collections of the Quran. So there is testimony within Islam that they're far from being one single unified Quranic text, that there are multiple collections in various states of completion. The question of translation is harder. Who is it to tell you that it's not an authentic translation? Generally, no Orthodox Muslim will recognize an English translation of the Quran as a translation. Theologically, you cannot translate the Quran. What you have to do is give a sense of the meaning. And so when you pick up a Quran, it has on the front normally the Quran, a commentary, or an English translation and commentary on the Arabic text.
You think a convert to Islam has to learn Arabic?
Exactly, Exactly. Yeah. Arabic is the only official language of Islam. It is the only language of the Quran. And so Muslims must learn Arabic if they are to access the Quran as the Quran for themselves. Now, of course, in one sense, it's a little bit, there's an equivocation, because there are multiple translations in various languages, and many Muslims themselves have translated the Quran into English. For example, if you've got the Penguin copy of the Islam, it's normally by Dawood. The gentleman in the back's got that. Most Muslims were so horrified by that translation that they decided they'd better start translating the Quran for themselves. And so Yusuf Ali, for example, is the most common English Quran in this country and most of the Western world. So here's a Muslim, an Orthodox Muslim, providing an English translation of the Quran. So there's obviously some slippage in what we mean by translation. Is there a form of textual criticism amongst Islamic scholars? There certainly is in relation to the Hadith or the Sunnah. A great effort was applied to wanting to know which saying attributed to the Prophet was really authentic and really said by him. And so you have a chain of going back into history. This was recorded by so-and-so, who heard it from 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 the lips of the Prophet. And the chain's called an isnad. And those texts are weighed in a way similar to the way textual criticism is done on our Bibles. But it's not done in the same way on the Quran itself. And Muslim scholars who have tried to do that have generally found themselves in trouble. For example, one of the best known Muslim theologians and scholars in this country and of recent age is Fazlur Rahman. He was forced out of Pakistan for his work on the text of the Quran. And you could go on the numbers of other Muslims who have wanted to step back and say, what can we look at historically, literally, or scientifically, without the trappings of dogma and theology. And so there's a great reluctance to apply textual criticism to the text of the Quran. Some do it, and when they publish their findings, they publish that there's variance. But of course, if you're in an Islamic university in the Middle East, it's normally the end of your career. It's very hard to have the freedom. And even with the text that we have now from Yemen, the German scholar Puin, who was asked to come and excavate and excise the Quranic text, has not been able to publish his works because the Yemeni authorities have taken the text away. He's scared that if he actually publishes what he's found, no one will ever have access to that document again. So there's a great reluctance to submit the Quran to the test of scientific textual criticism. Sue. That's a good question. If you're a Western convert, how do you become familiar with the Quran? All of those things. You do take Arabic classes. They're held at local mosques or at local Islamic study centres. There's all kinds of correspondence courses and home study courses and CD-ROMs that you can learn Arabic from. So you really must learn Arabic, and there's a great deal of resource and material available for that. If you can take informal classes with an older Muslim. But of course, the interesting thing, the sad thing in Islam, is that many, many Muslims go to all the trouble of learning Arabic, or at least reciting the Arabic text, but with no actual sense of the meaning of the words. And so some Muslims, go to great lengths to memorize the entire Quran, all 6,000 plus verses. And the tragedy is that many can do that, which is quite a feat, and yet not know the meaning of what they're reciting. So unless you know Arabic, you really are kind of once removed. Yes? That's a good... I'm going to do a whole lecture on that later on. Most of the Old Testament story is it contained in the Quran? How is it different? The short answer for now is it's not so much most, as in the narrative, but certainly a high percentage of all the major figures. So going back to Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, and Elijah and Elisha and Moses and Abraham and Job, all kinds of figures are there. The interesting thing is there are no 8th century prophets. You might want to think about why that would be the case and hold on to that. There is also, Jesus is also there. There is a reference, it seems, to the Acts of some of his apostles. So there's a lot of biblical material contained within the Quran. But as I alluded to, it is used in a very different way. The stories are told differently. And the various figures are employed to say things or to illustrate things that were either true of Muhammad, to substantiate his prophethood, or to teach the particular truths of Islam to Muslims in succeeding generations. An example that comes to mind quickly is that in the biblical story, Abraham is called to sacrifice Isaac, and God intervenes. In the Quran, it is Ishmael, and Ishmael is saved and becomes the continuer of the covenant line. Noah preaches like he does in the Bible, but the content of his preaching is geared toward Islamic doctrines. Abraham becomes a model, in one sense, of Muhammad's life. Muhammad is seen as a true prophet because look at these biblical prophets. We all know that they suffered and endured and were called to undergo all kinds of things, and that was the life of Muhammad. So it's present, but it's very different and used with a purpose.